It's recording right now.
Okay.
That's fine.
Okay. So could you tell me your full name and date of birth, please?
Yeah, John Christian Aidenberger. I'm born November the 16th, 1933.
Okay. And where were you born and raised?
Fairview, Alberta.
Okay.
In a little town about 350 miles northwest of Edmonton.
Okay. And went to school there?
Was born there, but wasn't raised there. Was raised in what's called the Battle River Country, which is about 100 miles east and north of Fairview, at two or three places, a little town called Whitelaw, a little town called North Star, Manning. My father joined the Air Force in 1939, and my mother was a teacher, and we kind of went where he went. He was too old to go overseas, and he went to a number of stations in Alberta and in Manitoba, and we came along. My mother taught, and I went to a variety of schools. In 1946, he was honorably discharged from the Air Force, and we returned to this little town called Whitelaw. I went to school there till grade 9, and then we moved to a place called Manning, where my father was a storekeeper, and I went to school to grade 12 there, and in grade 12, I did really well in grade 9. I was an honors student, and by the time grade 12 came along, I found out about women and whiskey, and it didn't fit with academics, and I was a miserable failure. And so I started a job working in the oil fields, and I worked in the oil fields in northern Alberta and Leduc until 1955, when I joined the Air Force, and I didn't join for any reasons that were save the country or fight communism. It was just there were no jobs, and it was handy, and I went and joined. There was none of this parades and bands. It was just a job. But I got interested in it. I became a navigator, and took the navigation training in Winnipeg, and then became what's called an airborne interception fella, and that was flying in the CF-100s, an all-weather fighter. Took the operational training unit training at Cold Lake, Alberta, and 1956 and 1957, I and my pilot were sent to Comox, where we flew out of Comox from 1957 till 1959. After that, I went to the Dew Mine for a year, and in middle 1960, I came back into the all-weather fighter business and went over to overseas to Marville in France, where I flew with 445 Squadron. And I understand your topic has to do with the Cuban Missile Crisis, and that's where my association with that particular event occurred.
In France.
Yeah.
So that was 1960 you went over to France?
1960, yeah.
1960. And you were the airborne intercepted navigator,
yeah,
on the CF-100s?
Yeah.
And you were trained in Cold Lake?
Yeah.
What sort of training did you receive there?
Well, there was sort of a three-phase training. We started out training with the on the B-25, a Mitchell bomber, World War II vintage, and in it was a radar set. And the idea of the airborne interception was that I was the radar operator, and you were able to pick up the enemy as a blip on the radar, and you would maneuver the aircraft so into such a fashion that you could shoot the other fellow down.
How did you determine that you were going to be the navigator?
It wasn't me, it was the luck of the draw,
yeah.
And me, you see, they have at that time, and they still do, they have a sort of a sausage machine pipeline, and what drives the training system is the need on the squadrons, and if they're short pilots, then more pilots are selected, navigators, if you're navigators, then they select the navigators. The navigator selection was always more demanding academically. So the benchmark to get into navigation training was always a little bit higher than if you wanted to be a pilot.
So when you were doing that training in Canada, what you would have just been preparing for any Cold War strategies, or just kind of in case?
No, we had rear. The threat was the Soviets,
yeah,
and they had bombers, and we flew out of Comox for 3 years, and we practiced against the Americans, B-52s and B-47s, but there was always the bears, Russian bears, the Russian bisons, the Russian badgers, that were comparable to the American things, and we were always on alert. We held alert, and we got scrambled, and we went up, and we went up armed, and had it been an enemy, we'd have flicked the switch on, and we'd have shot him down.
So part of your training would have been about Soviet technology?
A little bit, not much. Mainly air tech, not technology so much, but their airborne capability.
Mm-hmm. Which you worked against.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you were in France, were you on the with part of NATO? Or?
Yeah, part of NATO. Part of NATO. And we also had... it was the same sort of flying that we did in Canada, with the exception that the enemy was extremely real. They were always jamming us with fake radio messages, and where we were located and where the Russians and the East Germans, the Czechoslovakians and the Polish and all the rest of those folks were, was only 10 minutes away, 10 to 15 minutes away, whereas in Canada, you were hours mm-hmm. away, mm-hmm. And you really had to pay attention to the way you navigated and how come you navigated, and made sure that you didn't get too close to what we call the buffer zone, because if you crossed over, the Soviets would shoot you. Mm-hmm.
So you would make trips back and forth up to that line?
Not really. We didn't really do that except on the very odd occasion. Mainly we did a lot of practice intercepts upon each other and exercises against the British and the French and the Norwegians and all those kind of folks and ourselves. And we went down to Sardinia and flew the whole squadron. There was 18 aircraft on a squadron, and we flew them down plus the ground crew. Spend anywhere from 2 to 3 weeks firing rockets on a firing range down there, and this was to make sure that the aircrafts, when you pull the trigger, the rockets would actually mm-hmm. fire. Mm-hmm.
Did you feel that the threat was a lot more apparent when you were in Europe than in Canada?
Both was about the same, but it was a lot more intense in Europe than it was, mm-hmm. especially during the crisis that you're theming about, or writing about, or your topic area, because there's really three events that occurred over there during my time. One was the building of the Berlin Wall, which was more intense than the Cuban Missile Crisis, because it was very close, and that occurred in December of 1962. Or a little earlier than that. I think it was 61, excuse me, wrong year, because the Cuban Missile Crisis was in October 62. And then there was in 1963 was the Kennedy assassination. So that 2.5 year period was very, very dynamic and tense for us all.
What position did you hold at the time of the crisis in 62?
In 62, I was a line navigator, flying interceptors.
How many, do you know how many squadron, or how many groups were in your squadron when you were in
the... How many in the squadron? We had 18 aircraft.
18?
And each, we had a crew and a half per aircraft, so we had 18 pilots plus 9 and 18 airborne interceptions plus 9.
And you all lived on a base there?
No, some lived in the permanent Mary quarters, which was in a place called, I'll think of it in a minute, but we never did there. My wife and I, we had two children then, and we lived in Belgium, and which was about a half an hour drive to Marville, in a place called Ezel, then Bernholm, and for 2 years. And then after that, after the CF-100s were taken out of the order of battle, and that happened in early 1963, then I stayed on and went into the 104 program, but I don't believe that's you're interested in what happened after the missile crisis.
When you were part of NATO, you were flying in conjunction with the other countries that were in NATO at the time,
yeah.
But you would have been commanded still by the Canadian
yes.
forces.
Yes, there was what they call an air division, which was a headquarters that in turn reported to NATO, but it was located in Metz, France, and there were four RCAF bases, one in Marville, one in Rotonquin, one in Zweibrücken, and one in Baden-Solingen, each base having the same complement of squadrons, one all-weather fighter squadron and two Sabre squadrons, big fighter squadrons.
Okay. Prior to the Cuban Missile Crisis coming to a head, was Cuba a concern?
No.
Other than the Soviet aspect, that wasn't even kind of
wasn't
on the radar.
Certainly wasn't on my mind.
Yeah. What sort of information were you given about the crisis when this?
About the same as anybody would read in the paper.
Yeah.
Because I think that President Kennedy was quite forthcoming, and the pictures were on the newsreel. We didn't have. We had access to television, but it was French or German, not English. And newspapers, of course. So we had, there was no, to my full recollection, we never sat down in a briefing room like this and got a special sort of bunch of information. We mm-hmm. just didn't. Mm-hmm.
Were you called back? Were people that were on leave, were they called back?
Oh, yes, definitely. Everybody was on full strength, and we were. They have different levels of alert. There's the everyday kind of alert where you have two guys in two airplanes and they're ready to go on 5 minutes notice, and then there's another level of alert where you increase the number of aircraft, and then you have the highest level where every aircraft is fully manned and ready to go at a moment's notice, and we were at that particular level for a period of time. Mm-hmm.
Now, when the pictures came out that the U.S. have taken with their spy planes of Cuba, NATO being different than any sort of U.S.-Canadian alliance, would NATO need their own evidence to support that, or they would go with?
I mean, it was plain to the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, what we were going to do, have a French reconnaissance aircraft go have a look and get the same pictures.
Mm-hmm.
So there was,
apparent.
It was there, and yeah. there's no denying it.
Yeah. So when you were called back to the base and the alert had been raised, what then happened? Do you recall?
Oh, sure. We just sat around, played bridge.
Waited for something to happen.
Waited for something to happen.
Yeah.
And we flew practice missions. We kept on our daily schedule, but mm-hmm. what we did do was we never flew between Marville and the buffer zone. We always flew from Marville over France and over England, because the air orders were keep that. We didn't want any, because often you'd have your aircraft, 10 or 12 of them, hidden in one direction, and it would look to the Russians like they were coming at the Russians, when that's not the intent. You were going to fly up there and then turn back, but they didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just flew far. We did our practice missions far away from between Marville, if you look on a map, and where the Iron Curtain used to be, the Berlin and all of that mm-hmm. sort of thing, where that used to be. It's not a big territory, but we never flew in
the
day.
In the other direction,
no,
just to not provoke anything.
We practiced with the other day.
Yeah. Now, when this was going on, I've heard that some of the bases were evacuated from families. Was that the case with?
Well, ours was not, but it was a, it was a tough time. You see, my wife was in Marville. We had two children, and she was pregnant with a third. she was in Belgium, in Bertrand, excuse me, and misspoke herself. And the evacuation idea was as follows. It was that we had our telephone service, and when she got a telephone message from a, what we used to call a snowball, you know, one person would phone another, phone another, phone another, we'd have three people to phone, and then these people would phone three, and so on, that you had to evacuate. We were always had enough supplies to last for 72 hours. Mm-hmm. So she would jump in. The idea was that on this order, she'd jump in the car and go to Marville, where there was supposed to be an airplane, transport airplane, to haul them away. Mm-hmm. That never happened. Mm-hmm. And then the idea was, when you got to Marville, if there was no airplane there, which of course there wouldn't be, jumped in the car, and there she was, with me out flying around here and there, she would go to Calais, where a ship would be waiting. Never happened. So one day I asked Mary, I says, what are you really going to do? Because, you know, it could get very tense, and yeah, a lot of action could tense. She says, I'm just going to go over and bunk in with my neighbor friend here in Belgium, because they've been through this a dozen times, and they know how to survive under tough conditions, and I'll just stay right here. Mm-hmm. Smartest thing I ever heard anybody say about it. Business of evacuation under those years. Dumb, dumb, and not only that, stupid. Mm-hmm. Never happened.
Do you think people in Europe it was quite tense?
Oh, yeah.
Have just gone through?
Oh, yeah. And don't forget, we had always had, there was always difficulties. We had, you know, the Algerian revolution, the insurgents, and there was people being shot on streets down in, I'll think of that town in a minute, but we were, of course, Marville was in the north of France, which is a very socialistic communist sort of area, and they were very antagonistic to even their own government. And there used to be shootings of Algerians and shootings of French, and there'd be bodies floating down the river. And you didn't pick up hitchhikers, you did, and you always passed by groups fast, you never made eye contact, you just kept on with your own business.
Now, was there much action, air action, on the Soviet side of things?
Oh, yeah, same thing.
There was.
They do the same thing. We used to have to do what we call combat air patrol, which was boring, and we would go up and do a racetrack, and sometimes these combat air patrols, the idea of a combat air patrol was to have an aircraft in the air that could respond immediately to a threat. And these used to be what we call big racetracks. We'd go 50 miles this way, turn around, come 50 miles that way, go 50 miles, 50 mm-hmm. miles. And you do that for an hour, and it's just dreadfully boring. Well, the Russians were doing the same thing over on the other side, and they were going back and forth. And as you know from your rides on the airliners, there's a phenomenon called contrailing, in which the white stuff comes out of the engine. Of course, we did the same thing, so they could see our contrails and we could see theirs. And this fellow I was flying with one day, he did a roll which made a corkscrew in the contrail. Well, they could see the other guy, and he did the same thing.
Oh. They were just as bored as you.
They were just as bored as we were.
Now, when there was a ground radar that was keeping an eye on things at your base, and they would alert you.
It was not at our base. It was a place called Yellowjack, which was near Metz.
Okay.
And it was a large, complicated radar that had quite a long reach, and they were our controllers. We had our own specific Canadian controllers who controlled us, which meant, you know, when we went and we got onto their frequency, they said, head this way, climb to 35,000 feet, and blah, blah, blah.
So they would spy something and alert you to
They wouldn't alert. They wouldn't alert us directly. The arrangement was that if they saw something that was coming, that they judged to be a threat, mm-hmm. then they would tell their headquarters, and in turn the headquarters would scramble us. Now, there were some instances in which we would be scrambled directly from Yellowjack, but generally in missile, during these last 3 years, the Berlin Wall, the missile crisis, Kennedy's assassination. The scrambles, which were always armed, were always very carefully judged before you went, because they just didn't want to make any mistakes. Mm-hmm. So that was that.
What do you mean by scrambles?
Scramble means that your aircraft is ready to go flying, sitting on the runway in a bit of a hangar. I got some pictures if you want to see. And what you do is you have a little room like this that you're sleeping in, or resting in, or playing cards in, and then the bell, big bell, would ring, dingy, 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 and then you run and jump in the airplane and strap in, fire it up, and you're supposed to be airborne within 5 minutes. So it's a word that comes out of World War II. If you remember something, you may have seen some of those War II fighter films where they're going fast and go, 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 go. That's called scramble.
Quick.
Yeah.
if you came across a Soviet threat in the air, what were you to do?
Shoot them down.
Just immediately.
Yeah.
And what sort of area did you cover? Was there?
It varied. It was divided up, kind of, but and we saw, of course, the most efficient way to look after the airspace was to center on your own base, mm-hmm. and so it was kind of an arc. It wasn't a square thing, it was kind of an arc, and mainly looked after that.
And that was, the areas were divided up with the other countries?
Yeah, other countries.
Yeah.
I don't think it was very formally organized that way because it was such a fluid environment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm absolutely sure there was some master plan which says this, you look after this, you look after that, you look after that. But that's not what I've ever experienced.
Mm-hmm. Did you have much interaction with the other countries in the world?
Oh, sure.
You did?
Oh, yeah.
So it was a fairly amiable relationship with them?
Oh, yeah. We grew exchanges with the with the Danes and with the Norwegians, and they were always a good place to go and do exchange would mean that you would take your airplane and fly with them
mm-hmm.
as part of their squadron for a period of a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So you lived right with them and did what they did, and it's all very sensible and civilized.
It's quite amazing that they can be, that everybody worked together. So
it's easy. You see the. When you're on the hangar line, all airplane and all air crew, no matter which nationality, are all are pretty much part of the same
boat.
You know, we think alike, we whatever.
Were the men that you were involved with, that you worked with, were they aware of the magnitude of the crisis in for the people in Canada and in the U.S.?
Oh, yeah.
And were you aware of what was going on in the other, with the Navy and that kind of stuff?
We knew what the Navy was doing. We mm-hmm. didn't know specifically, just mm-hmm. like the Navy didn't know what we were doing specifically. Mm-hmm. But we knew darn well the Navy was out and about and involved in very, very close engagements with the Russians and in working in concert with the United States Navy and Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
But in air defense, our main job was controlling the airspace, making sure there was no threat got through there.
Mm-hmm. Were you aware at all of the raising of the Canadian alert? Was NATO anything to do with preparedness? All part of the same.
There's two levels of communication. One is official, the other is from Office of Telegraph. You see, what I mean by that is informal. Somebody mm-hmm. phones somebody, mm-hmm. phones somebody, says, did you know that this is going to be a
Were there any changes made as a result of the crisis? Any in your training or in your routine?
No. See, at the end of the crisis, it just happened to coincide with the taking out of the order of battle of the CF-100 because its usefulness as an air weapons platform had gradually diminished. The enemy. The Russians had developed a whole lot of new technology and new airframes, and our machine just and couldn't do the job anymore. It was just too old, so it was taken out of the air, order of battle. And the bulk of the Seattle Hunters were then thrown over to Prestwick, and parts were taken to them, and they were made into aluminum pots and pans.
What were they replaced with?
Well, we got out of the air defense business altogether in Europe, and at first, so we went into, our mission then became nuclear delivery with the CF-104 Starfighter.
Did you feel that in, if there was some sort of imminent attack, did you feel your training was adequate to?
Oh yeah, we were absolutely confident, and we had. You see, you get a fair appreciation of how good you are by air fighting with your own people, but you get a better appreciation when you're air fighting against the Danes or the Russians, or not the Russians, but the French and the English and the West Germans, of course. And we were always top dog. Mm-hmm.
Did you feel that the Russians had some idea that the American and NATO countries' kind of preparedness was going to be more effective than their own?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you just can't keep these secrets. Now, they may BS and bluster a lot, but we knew what they were doing, and they knew what we were doing.
Mm-hmm. How crucial do you think the role that Canada played was to the outcome of everything, either as part of NATO or...
I think the most important thing to think is that in this moment of crisis, and it was, I mean, the threat was real, and the threat was imminent. It wasn't anything like this foo-for-all that is going on now in Iraq. You know, that it really, really was there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the main thing to remember is that we pulled our weight. In other words, when one of these crises arises, it is impossible to put ducks on the fence that you don't have on the ground. If you don't have the assets in place, you can't just go out and get a bunch. You have to have them in place.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, we did. Mm-hmm. We did have the air assets, we had the naval assets, we had the army assets. And we had a population in Canada, the United States, and in NATO that fully understood the implication of a nuclear exchange. I mean, school children practiced getting under school desks and things like that. Mm-hmm. I don't think you ever did that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my kids did.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a different sort of sense of what's on the river. It's absolutely astonishing to me. The threat of nuclear exchange really hasn't gone away, and yet we don't seem to give it up.
Mm-hmm.